Well, friends, I'll say again, it is good to be together on this last Sunday of winter. It is still winter despite what it feels like outside. I'm thankful to Eric for the trust with the pulpit and thankful to all of you for the trust as well. Indeed, friends, next Sunday is Palm Sunday, which makes next week the last Sunday of Lent. Easter is 2 weeks away. So today we have another chance to lean in to our Lenten anticipation and to make space for the springtime of resurrection that is still around the corner. With that in mind, will you join me in a moment in prayer? O God, who waits with us in our waning winter weariness, take the words of my mouth and make the meditations of our hearts as pleasing and acceptable to you. The one who saves and makes all things new. Amen. So Easter indeed is a couple of weeks away, but in the temporal trickiness of church leadership, I feel like I have been time traveling back and forth from Lent to Easter and beyond as I've been planning and preparing for upcoming events and programs. Take, for example, the Easter Bonnet competition that our LGBTQIA+ ministry is preparing to host at the end of our church-wide feast on Easter Sunday. I first heard about this competition when I was still living in Kansas City, Missouri, where I was when I started the interview process. And this was one of the first things someone mentioned when they were talking about who Christ Church is. So I've been excited for it ever since. Not only is this a demonstration, I think, of how our LGBTQIA+ ministry is more than some independent, isolated, special interest group, but is indeed a fabric of our community life. I also think that this competition is the perfect way to celebrate the splendid springtime of Easter. I can't think of a better way than strutting around with some fabulous floral hats on Sunday afternoon. I will say, though, that I'm glad that Easter is still a couple of weeks away because I have barely begun planning my own bonnet, but otherwise, everything is in place for that morning. We even have all of our judges lined up, including the one Jeff Ridenour, who is serving as our reigning champion from last year's first annual Easter bonnet competition. I think that Jeff might be quite the contender in this year's competition, but he was gracious enough to opt out of competing and decided instead to judge, which may just be a chance to read those of us whose hats will surely pale in comparison to his craft. I'm thinking exclusively about myself. This time-traveling trickery of Lententide church preparation took another twist, though, when I first read the gospel reading for today's liturgy. Last week, we heard from John 3, and heard John 3:16, "For God so loved the world." And Eric gave an incredible sermon in which he talked about how John 3 says that God sent Jesus to save the world, to evoke eternal life, and not to condemn. But then today, we just heard Barbara read from John 12, in which Jesus reads his current moment and declares that the hour has come and now is the judgment of this world. Now, this judgment has to be very different than the judging we'll be doing in a couple weeks regarding bonnets, but didn't Jesus say that he was not here to judge? What does this chapter mean for us then? John 12 comes from what may be seen as an interlude in John's gospel between Acts 1 and Act 2. In Act 1, who Jesus is revealed through stories of seven signs or seven miracles. And then in Act 2, Jesus heads towards the climax of his story with the Easter plot, the Last Supper, the betrayal, the arrest, the crucifixion, and the resurrection. It makes sense then, I think, that we read this passage from John 12 this morning with just 2 weeks left in Lent. But what doesn't quite make as much sense at first is that already, before the climax of the Easter event, Jesus is saying that the hour is here, and now is the judgment of this world. Yet had he not just taught that he was not here to judge or condemn, but to save the world? I saw a painting recently that helped me better understand what it might mean to encounter this hour of God's judgment in our real world today. The artist Aaron Douglas and I actually share some interesting biographical details. Douglas's first full-time job as an artist was teaching at a high school in Kansas City, Missouri. He worked with youth at a school where some of the youth I worked with in my first full-time ministry job were actually students. And then Douglas, after a few years in KC, moved here to New York City to further unfold his career as an artist. And he relocated to Harlem, just on the other side of the neighborhood in which I now live. From there, though, our biographies diverge. It was soon after his move to Harlem in 1925, a solid 100 years before I moved here, that Aaron Douglas's career took off. One of the pivotal moments in his career was creating a series of prints that was included in the 1927 publication of a book called God's Trombones. This one is not from 1927, but is a nice reprint. This book is a collection of poetic sermons by James Weldon Johnson, accompanied each with a print that Douglas made. Several years later, Douglas turned his prints into full-scale paintings that you can now see on display at the Met in a beautiful Harlem Renaissance exhibit. The last one of these paintings is called The Judgment Day, and it is this brilliant, cubism-inspired green and purple painting in which an angelically winged person blows a trumpet while holding another key in the hand. Behind them is a lightning bolt and a ray of light that illuminates other figures who also reach up, not in response to punishment, but rather in what I see as a longing for liberation, a reaching towards things to be made right. The series of prints and the paintings that accompany them follow a storyline that starts with Creation Day and works all the way to Judgment Day, including stories of Noah and the Ark, of the prodigal son, and of the crucifixion. And I was so moved when I saw the long wall that held all of them in person. This ancient story that was retold a century ago through these Art Deco-y Harlem Renaissance-y images suddenly came to life to me in a new way, seeing the story here in 2024, in a world in which much has changed, but plenty of people still reach out longing for liberation. In the preface to this book, God's Trombones, James Weldon Johnson says that this collaboration with Douglas was an attempt to capture some of the aliveness that they knew in African-American preaching and congregational life of their time. It was very much in that way a project of the Harlem Renaissance. This book is a collection of poetry, of poetic sermons, and each is themed around a stage in that same story from creation to Judgment Day. But in telling this story, this collection tricks with time because it tells a story that's not just about the past or about the future, but it's about the present, about what's going on right now. Scholar and priest John Shelby Spong looks at John 12 and spells out the temporal trickiness of this passage by saying that Jesus' declaration about God's hour is a call to recognize that our time and God's time are not the same. If the word Lent comes from a word that means lengthen, perhaps hearing John 12 today, especially at the end of Lent, reminds us that Lent is not just about the linear lengthening of days as springtime approaches, but might be about a wider expansion of our understanding of the depths of God's time and this surprise that God's time is always present. John 3 did say that God did not send Jesus to condemn the world, but it continued to say that those who do not believe are condemned already. And that is more or less what I think Jesus reiterates in John 12. He says that his story reveals a new timeline for the world by revealing what is actually right in the world. With his death, Jesus says that God draws all people to himself, which means that God is giving the whole world a new story with which it can understand itself. It's a new perspective that shows how God's story is always present. Here then, judgment is not about punishment. Judgment, instead, is revelation. It is unveiling, it is truth-telling, it is showing something that needs to be seen. Think passages like John 12 and anywhere in which it talks about God as judge or punisher, condemning, make more sense if we know God to be less like a courtroom judge doling out eternal punishment and see God more as an artist crafting something out of the fabric of life itself and life eternal. James Weldon Johnson was inspired to write God's Trombones after a preaching conference that was coincidentally held in Kansas City. In the preface to this book, he describes how black preaching had changed in recent decades, but one pastor at that conference revived an older tradition in which he simply gave a sermon that told that story of God's work from creation to judgment day, from beginning to end. And that sermon sparked the room with energy. Johnson describes the moment as alive and quivering, and says that the preacher's voice was resonant and deep in a way that could be compared not to an organ or a trumpet, but rather a trombone. And with that deep resonance, suddenly everyone could hear and feel this story was more than a myth distant from their moment in time, but was a story that God was still unfolding in their presence and in their real lives. Johnson's poem for the Judgment Day reads like a song. He was a songwriter too. He actually co-authored the song Lift Every Voice and Sing, which we now know to be the Black National Anthem. But in the Judgment Day, he writes this. In that great day, God's going to rain down fire. And I feel old earth a-shuddering, and I see the graves a-bursting. O sinner, where will you stand? At the end of this arc, this great narrative of God creating and caring for and loving for and now judging the world, this poem professes a judgment of revelation and not courtroom condemnation. It asks, do you see where you are in God's story? Do you know that you too are a part of this play? Towards the end of the poem might be my favorite line, which it says, I hear a voice crying, time shall be no more. With the wave of God's hand, God will blot out time and start the wheel of eternity. God reveals to us this wheel of eternity by revealing to us this full story that God is telling with our lives here and now. God does not want to judge anybody. This is what scholar James Allison says as he talks about how Jesus' coming into the world has as its end not condemnation or punishment, but rather its end is to create a belief in the absolute aliveness of God. Allison describes Jesus' death, just like Jesus does here in John 12, as something that's not a supernaturally powerful sacrifice that finally appeases God so that we can be forgiven. Instead, God already looked at us with grace and forgiveness. And Jesus' death was a moment in which God became identified with the victim of sacrifice, the victim of all of the murderous mechanisms of society. When Jesus was put to death on the cross, God identified with the victim of that violence. And in that, Jesus came to be the judging point for how it is to be seen that we humans are behaving. Jesus became a new rubric for understanding the reality that we live in and a new story that we might tell. Already here in John 12, we see that God is giving the whole world a new way of understanding itself. And in these glimpses we get every moment along the way, we start to feel this wheel of God's eternity. And time as we once knew it is simply no more. Once we see this, we cannot unsee the life of God at work in the world. In a book that twists another text that we have heard on our Lenten journey, James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time talks about God's judgment and the world as he knew it. Baldwin published this book in 1963, and it was immediately impactful, influencing a lot of what became the civil rights movement. But reading it today shows how his words are eminently important, too. Baldwin got this title, The Fire Next Time, from an old slave song that sang, "God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time." A few weeks ago in worship, we read that Noah story and learned about how God gave the world a sign of covenant life with the rainbow over Noah's sky. And God promised to never again destroy the world with a flood. Baldwin sees some leeway in the particularity of that phrase, that God will not punish the world with a flood, says that God will judge the world with a purifying fire. Baldwin wonders if the root of hatred and violence seen in the evident racism in our country's history and our country's present, Baldwin wonders if that is rooted in a refusal to see reality. He says that when people shut their eyes to reality, they invite their own destruction. Or like the words of Jesus, if people refuse to see the truth of God's living word, they are already condemned. But in this judgment of this purifying fire, Baldwin senses an opportunity for us all to become more alive. He says it this way: "Perhaps the whole root of our human trouble is that we will sacrifice the beauty of our lives to taboos, to crosses, sacrifices, steeples, to races, armies, flags, nations, all in order to deny the fact of death, the fact that we one day will die, which is the only fact that we have. It seems to me that we ought to rejoice in the fact of death, ought to decide indeed to earn one's death by confronting with passion the conundrum of life. One is responsible to life. It is the small beacon in that terrifying darkness from which we come and to which we shall all return." Baldwin is not talking about celebrating death, but rather not ignoring the fact that we will all die and embracing the life that we do have. God does not want to judge anybody, but God does want to reveal to us this sheer wonder of God's own life, even in the face of what we've been calling over the past few weeks a kingdom of death, the systems of destruction and dominance and all the ways that actually distract us from death's facts and from rejoicing in this conundrum of life. Friends, we live in a world in which kids like Next Benedict are bullied and beat up at school for simply being non-binary, for not being normal. Came out last week that Next's death was by suicide at the end of their story. And I think in that, God's judgment is here, telling us that that is not okay, that we can and that we need to build a different world together in which all people can live. We live in a world at war, too, which people in Gaza, people in other countries, Ukraine and beyond, are being killed simply for wanting to survive on a land that they love. In each death, God's judgment is here, showing us that humanity needs to cease fire, to stop considering any human cost okay for political purposes or the pretense of peace. We live in a world in which much indeed has changed since the words and images that Douglas, Johnson, and Baldwin all created, but their judgment still rings true, for we still have a list of ways in which racism is very much alive in our country and world. God's judgment is still here, giving us a glimpse of what the world could be as we work together and reach towards things being made right. Maybe it would be better said that God does not want to punish anybody, because God does judge us. But by revealing the truth of how we are living and how we might come more truly alive. So maybe there is some theological significance in including something like judging each other's Easter bonnets on Easter Sunday. Not because we need to compare how fabulous we are from one another, considering some better or worse, but because judgment is actually a celebration of the splendid colors of God's life among us. The work for which we prepare ourselves today on this penultimate Sunday of Lent is to go about bearing the judgment of God, sharing the story of Jesus, which he is lifted up in a way that shows the whole world what it means to simply and truly be alive. Amen.